The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A warmer, friendly hello. Welcome to lovely Las Vegas for Coast to Coast Soup with myself, Greg Spears, and now part of the VEASAN family of podcasts. And we've got a great podcast for you. In the second segment, we're going to be joined by Curtis Rogers. He does a great job over there with 710 ESPN in the city of Seattle. We're going to be chatting with him about Arizona's possible run to a Final Four, how Gonzaga. They've got a little bit of a rough one. We're going to be talking about the main first four game for today in Rutgers versus Notre Dame as well. So we're going to be having a nice wide-ranging chat with Curtis in the second segment. Then in the final segment, I'm going to give you guys picks and analysis on every game on the betting board for this college basketball Wednesday as we hit some bank shots. First things first, always do love to be able to answer Twitter questions on this podcast. And we've got one or two ways to be able to fire those in. First one is my Twitter timeline at GRSCordy1. Keep in mind, letters EM. Naming does not matter, so as per usual, please send these into the timeline, and the other way is via an Apple Podcast review. If you rate this podcast 5 stars, it is very much appreciated. And then from there, you're able to find whatever you'd like to hear on this podcast via that 5-star review. Most of the questions today were involving how Hunter Maldonado wound up having 10 turnovers in his game yesterday, so we really didn't get too much of actual, like, handicapping questions. I know that there were quite a few of you guys that were asking me about the Colorado State sort of travel situation that wound up getting cleared up, so we don't have really too much to address there. But with that said, what we do have to address is what we wound up seeing in college basketball on Tuesday. So let's take a look back at it, try to find some trends, and try to get to know these teams a little bit better.
A games from yesterday is Greg buzzing about. Here is the rowdy recap.
We just brought it up. The fact that Wyoming winds up losing by 8 points to Indiana in a game in which Hunter Maldonado wound up having 10 turnovers in this game, and it just did not wind up going well for him. Meanwhile, for Indiana, what didn't wind up going well for them is their shooting. They wound up going 2 of 13 from 3-point range, but Trace Jackson Davis was the main elixir in this game. 29 points, 9 rebounds. He had himself a tremendous game, and really, if you take a look at it, you had one other player in Jordan Geronimo who really stepped up, and Geronimo could actually be a big cog for this Indiana team moving forward. He's been very hit or miss, but in this game, he was terrific. 7 of 11 from the floor, 15 points, 7 rebounds. You take out the full Trace Jackson Davis along with Geronimo. What you wound up having for Indiana is a team that wound up going 9 of 35 from the floor, so that was very fascinating. Jackson Davis wound up going 9 of 11 at the free throw line. What that means is that all their players outside of Trace Jackson Davis, they went 3 of 9 at the free throw line, and I mentioned it with Mr. Maldonado. 10 turnovers. He did wind up having 21 points. He also did wind up missing 3 free throws in this game. Wyoming stayed live because they were able to go 6 of 19 from 3-point range. Gray Mike, he did have 17 points, 9 rebounds. He had 5 turnovers of himself, but tell that Wyoming was not able to get anything going on offense. In Indiana, they survive in advance. They're going to be facing off against St. Mary's. You did wind up having Texas A&M Corpus Christi fall to Texas Southern by a count of 76-67. Corpus Christi was up in this game by a count of 61-59 with about 6 minutes remaining. And then from there, the Texas Southern defense was stifling. And for Corpus Christi, what really costed them in this game, they were supposed to be the better free throw shooting team, shooting right around 76% of the line. Southern, they were shooting more like 66-67% of the line. Texas Southern went 26 of 35 at the charity stripe. Corpus Christi, 9 of 19. That is your difference right there, as Simeon Fryer was able to put up 12 points, 9 rebounds for Corpus Christi, but Texas Southern, they do a solid job winning the rebound battle by a count of 45-37, and for Texas Southern, they did wind up committing 15 turnovers in this game to Corpus Christi's 9, but with that said, you did wind up having Bryson Etienne have 21 points in this game. He wound up going 9 of 9 at the free throw line, and for Texas Southern, they wound up having the majority of their scoring come in off the bench, as they wound up having a grand total of 55 points come in off their bench. So very interesting in that one. And Bryson Gresham, 13 rebounds and 6 blocks as well. That was pretty solid. Out there in the NIT, you wind up seeing some very fascinating games as VCU, they just wind up running roughshod over Princeton by a count of 90-79. VCU, 6 of 12 from 3-point range. They were pretty much averaging 1.5 points per field goal attempt. They only turned the ball over 7 times. And for Princeton, they've got quite a few guys entering in the transfer portal, but Jalen Llewellyn, who's one of those names in the portal, he wound up having 13 points. Princeton, 9 of 26 from 3-point range, and did a halfway decent job on the glass, winning the battle by kind of 35-33, but Princeton, a team that is outside the top 200 with regards to points allowed on a per-possession basis, could not get it done here. Belmont winds up blowing a double-digit lead against Vanderbilt, this one by a count of 82-71. In this one, you did wind up having Belmont get up early by 12 points. Vanderbilt was able to claw their way back in. This game was tight. It was a one-point game with about 4 minutes remaining, and then Belmont, well, they wound up flailing down the stretch as Vanderbilt wound up getting a very big performance. 24 points in total out of Jordan Wright. He was able to chip in their 7 rebounds. And for Vanderbilt, you did wind up having this team go 18 of 23 at the free throw line. Belmont went 9 of 10, but where Belmont went wrong is that they just could not do a good job on the glass. 42-28, and a big reason why, Liam Robbins, the 7-footer who is back in the fold for this Vanderbilt team, he wound up coming in and he did a solid job giving the team 14 points, 6 boards, 3 blocks, and then off the bench as well. Quentin Malera Brown was able to give this team 8 points, 13 rebounds, averaging more like 5.5 boards per contest. So it's going to be interesting to see what we wind up getting out of them in the NIT. Oklahoma was the top-rated KenPom team that did not make the NCAA tournament, and they looked like it against Missouri State. 89-72, the final. 12-25 from 3-point range is what Oklahoma wound up going with. Umaj Gibson being able to chip in their 28 points, and for Missouri State, Isaiah Mosley, he came to play 28 points, 10 rebounds, but just not enough for Missouri State to be able to get to the window. You do wind up having Xavier survive in advance, but it's a double-digit favorite against Cleveland State, unable to cover. 72-68 the final. So Xavier now is their third win in their last 11 games, but yeah, their warts in this one. 7-26 from 3-point range. They wind up losing the rebound battle by a count of 42-37, and for Cleveland State, they win this game if they go better than 1 of 12 from 3-point range. So not very encouraging what we wound up seeing out of the X-Men. It was not necessarily a good first half for Texas A&M. They're unable to cover against Alcorn State, as this one was a final of 74-62, as you wound up having Alcorn State get up 19-13 with about 5 minutes left in the first half. And then from there, A&M was able to roll for Texas A&M. They wound up going just 4 of 20 from 3-point range. Have to be encouraged by the free throw shooting, though. 26 of 28 at the charity stripe, including Hassan Diarra coming on off the bench. He went 8 of 8 at the charity stripe. And for Alcorn State, they wound up just committing a couple too many fouls. Texas A&M wound up getting a relatively friendly whistle as Linnell Henry, 16 points, 10 rebounds in this one. And Tyrese Radford, 2 touchdowns in this one, 14 points, 14 rebounds. So he did a very solid job there. Oregon was really your main money line winner when it came to what we wound up seeing in NIT action, 83-72. We'll get to one from the College Basketball Classic in a second, but for Oregon, they wound up getting down early in this game, but Dana Ullman, he had his guys ready to play without Will Richardson and without Infali Dante, which kind of assumed that Richardson is going to be out until further notice with a mysterious illness. They were able to still have a relatively solid backcourt. Davion Armand, Jacob Young were able to combined for 36 points. You wound up having this Oregon team have just 8 turnovers in this contest, so they did a relatively solid job there. And for Utah State, they wound up going 13 of 21 at the free throw line, 12 turnovers, had a advantage down low of Justin Beam being able to give them 9 points, 16 rebounds as they won the rebound battle. Utah State did by a count of 41-39, but just unable to can shots, had a little bit of a tough time out there in the backcourt, and Oregon winds up surviving and advancing in the NIT. Credit to the Bonnies for surviving and advancing as well. They wind up flying out from New York pretty much at the last minute, and they are able to get the job done late against Colorado, 76-68, a 5-man rotation, by the way, and a game that was relatively tight in the final 2 minutes as St. Bonaventure was pretty much tied up 68-68 with about 2:30 remaining, and then they wind up being able to put up the final 8 points in this one to be able to get the job done. You had Jalen Attaway be able to give the team 17 points as St. Bonaventure just 6 points off the bench, but they go 10 of 20 from 3-point range. Meanwhile, for Colorado, they go just 7 of 25 from distance, and for Colorado, they do wind up winning the rebound battle 31-25, but with that said, St. Bonaventure only 9 turnovers, Oshuni 4 blocks, 13 points, 10 boards, so St. Bonaventure, they get the job done in another game that wound up going over, and then the under that we wound up seeing in the NIT, well, it was on the biggest total, and it wound up going way under, 63-50. Washington State winds up being able to get it done against Santa Clara. Santa Clara just 3 of 23 from three-point range in this one. They couldn't get anything going. Tyrell Ghost Roberts, 23 points. He goes 7 of 16 from three-point range. Washington State, they wind up playing even up on the glass, but Washington State also just 8 turnovers in this game compared to Santa Clara's 12. For Santa Clara, it was really Jalen Williams trying to be able to keep the team in the game. 19 points, 15 rebounds. So Washington State was able to survive in advance. I talk about a big money line underdog hit outside of the NIT. That'll be with USC Upstate in the Basketball Classic. First of that, really, tournament's history, because it used to be the CBI. 80-74, they wind up being able to get it done. Upstate goes 10 of 22 from three-point range. Appalachian State wound up taking 16 fewer field goal attempts than Upstate because they were forced into 16 turnovers. This for an Appalachian State team committing right around 10 turnovers per contest. So very unlike them in this one. And you wound up seeing with USC Upstate, them pretty much playing even up on the glass. Lost that battle 34-33. And Adrian Delph, Donovan Gregory combined 48 points for Appalachian State. But Josh Aldrich wound up going 9 of 14 from the floor for 24 points with USC Upstate getting 1 point off the bench in this one. And if you're just taking a look at what we wound up getting in college basketball yesterday, you did wind up seeing the overs actually really hitting just across all of these games, as you wound up having 8 overs to 4 unders. Now, obviously, one of those unders wound up coming in the NCAA tournament, and underdogs even Steven split 6-6 against the spread, with that big money line hit being with USC Upstate out there in the Basketball Classic. So that's what we wound up seeing in college basketball on Tuesday. Now, let's turn the page forward to Wednesday. Look at the first four and just talk about some of the draws that the one seeds wound up getting in the NCAA tournament. And we'll be doing that with Curtis Rogers. And just as a friendly reminder, if you're looking to get a little bit more madness here in the NCAA tournament, the VSiN College Basketball Betting Guide is here for you. It is now out, and with going to VSiN.com/madness, you wind up paying $19. And as a result, you get everything that we wind up doing at VSiN now through the conclusion of the NCAA tournament, which is going to be April 5th. And with that, you wind up getting streaming to our full video that includes the Greg Peterson Experience, the Betting the Bracket show that I'm going to be doing every single Sunday as well. So we've got you guys covered there. The College Basketball Betting Guide that I was mentioning a little bit earlier, it's got previews on all 68 teams, how to fill out a bracket. If you're looking for my bracket in paper form, it is in there as well. That is at vsin.com/madness. 19 bucks for everything that we wind up doing throughout the NCAA tournament. And coming up next, we got a great chat with Curtis Rogers coming up here on Coast to Coast Hoops with myself, Greg H. Peterson, now part of the VSiN Family Podcast. And we're back here in lovely Las Vegas for Coast to Coast Hoops with myself, Greg Hughes, and now part of the VSiN Family Podcast. And it is great to be joined by our guest, as Curtis Rogers does absolutely amazing work over there with 710 ESPN in Seattle. He does a lot of production work. He does the Seattle Sports Night, the Seattle Sports Saturday podcast as well. You're going to be able to catch him doing pre- and post-game work for the Seattle Mariners as well. And this is a man that is dialed into college basketball. He is an alum of Arizona. Guy really does a great job of covering a little bit of everything. As to be able to follow Curtis on Twitter, that is at a kid from Kent altogether. You're able to find him on Instagram at that same handle as well. And my friend, it is great to have you aboard. Thank you.
Greg, it is great to be with you. It is the greatest portion of the sports calendar. It's March, it's madness, it's the NCAA tournament, it's all here. This week, it gets going. I know you're through the roof excited for what we're about to see over the next 3 or 4 weeks here. I'm super pumped for what's about to unfurl here in front of our very eyes. I cannot wait for these games to get going.
I cannot wait as well, and I'm sure that you can't wait to see what we wind up getting out of Arizona in the NCAA tournament, so I'll lead you to this first things first. Any chance that we wind up seeing Kirk Kreisa play in any of these games, because we wind up seeing the photo of his leg on social media, and boy, oh boy, that thing wound up looking really, really ugly, because, I mean, as I'm filling out my bracket, I just have to think that if Kirk Kreisa winds up playing, he certainly is going to be so far from 100% that it's really not going to make a difference at this point.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when he comes back. I don't necessarily think there's a question if he comes back. I think Right now, the plan is to take it game by game. I really don't see him playing in round one against either Wright State or Bryant. I don't think that's going to be even crossing the mind of Tommy Lloyd. I don't think he wants to potentially, you know, ruin any possibility of Kirk Creasa re-injuring that ankle of his. And like you mentioned, the picture that Creasa posted on social media over the weekend was gnarly. That thing was purple and black and blue and just from about, you know, his toes to like his mid-calf. It was just not what you want your ankle to look like. But seeing how Arizona performed in the Pac-12 tournament against Colorado and against UCLA, I mean, there was a drop-off, I would say, in their offensive production, but not much. Justin Kyer, very capable. And Dalen Terry, I think, really took over a lot of that load. Playing point guard, he finished with 7 assists in the Pac-12 title game against UCLA. So maybe there's a possibility that Terry gets some more run at point guard, kind of plays that, you know, sort of like Scottie Pippen role in a way. Not saying that that's Dalen Terry, a player comparison to him, but he is a stat sheet stuffer. He's going to fill up the box score any which way possible. I think a second round appearance for Kirk Creasa might be a little more likely if Arizona wants to roll the dice. And look, that second round game, if they get past the 16 seeded game, which look, is more than likely to happen. Seton Hall and TCU, I still think the gap between who Arizona is as a team and what either Seton Hall and TCU are, I think the gap there is still big enough for Arizona to get away with playing Justin Kyer in the spot that Kirk Creasa has filled in the starting lineup this year. But if you can get to the second weekend, if Arizona gets to the second weekend in the Sweet 16, where they're going to be probably facing either Illinois or Houston, one of those two teams, and an Illinois team that played Arizona earlier this season, the Wildcats getting the win in Champaign, I think you can definitely expect to see Kirk Creasa back if they make it to the Sweet 16.
Yeah, I think that Arizona should be able to make it to the Sweet 16. From there, I think it's going to be really interesting because if, like I said, if Creasa winds up playing, it might be interesting in that if he's not 100%, it could actually wind up hurting the Wildcats a little bit more because we saw them in the Pac-12 tournament without him. Granted, the defense wasn't necessarily on par, but the offense, it was certainly there for this team. Odama Ball wound up being able to hit a couple of threes. He's a very good international prospect, and he's a guy that's actually able to play relatively solid minutes. Arizona has a luxury in that they're one of the deepest teams in all of college basketball. So if you do wind up setting up for an Arizona versus Villanova Elite Eight matchup, which I currently have on my bracket, I do think that that is one that is going to be very fascinating.
Absolutely. I like that you brought up Odama Ball, somebody that's just kind of been waiting in the wings all season long. Had never really cracked the rotation up until late in the regular season. They started giving him more run. He played a career high in minutes against Cal on senior day, even though he's a true freshman. And then, look, stepping into that role against UCLA, there was tons of foul trouble on, you know, guys in that championship game. Pelle Larson, I know, was in foul trouble a lot. He also had Justin Kyer in foul trouble for most of the championship game, too. Kyer picked up 3 early fouls against UCLA. They needed somebody to give them minutes, and not just minutes, but also production. Ball came in, hit a couple of big threes. At one point in the first half, he was the leading scorer for Arizona. Kept the tide, you know, relatively calm, and then Arizona was able to take over in the second half and roll their way to a Pac-12 tournament championship. So, I mean, look, any kind of production out of those guys. I know Arizona earlier in the year had planned on having Kim Akin Jr. a part of their rotation. He was dismissed from the team around the turn of the semester, and then it just really never looked to fill that spot. Akin Jr. obviously being the former Big Sky Defensive Player of the Year with Eastern Washington. So they just went with an 8-man rotation pretty much the entire regular season and also into the postseason. So Ball stepping into that role, I'm intrigued to see how much playing time he will get in the NCAA tournament, considering how, I guess, raw he could be. But I do know that, you know, they think the world of him. I think next year is going to be a year where we see him really emerge, especially with guys like Ben Mather and most likely headed to the NBA.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the rotation for Arizona is going to be looking without Kirk Creasa, because you did wind up having them do a very solid job without him in the Pac-12 tournament. As we do have Curtis Rogers, your enemy, right here on the podcast. And Curtis, we've got for Wednesday a pair of first four games. Obviously, not the most rambunctious slate in the world with Wright State going up against Bryant, and then you got Rutgers versus Notre Dame. But I actually do think that this Rutgers-Notre Dame game is going to be relatively intriguing, because you got a Rutgers team that they're just not the same team whenever they wind up hitting the road. And it's a Notre Dame team that, to put it politely, they just really don't play any defense whatsoever. And I think that you're going to have a very intriguing game here out here in Las Vegas. This is a relative pick'em game, and I think rightfully so. I give an edge to Rutgers in this game. I'm not sure where you stand on it, but I do think that Rutgers has a shot to be able to get the job done. And then from there, they'd be able to play an Alabama team that we've seen them lose to Georgia already this season.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at this game between Rutgers and Notre Dame, I look at just who the best player on the floor is going to be. And Ron Harper Jr., to me, jumps off the page as the best player on the floor. He's had a few big shots this season. And I look at what Rutgers is capable of. They knocked off Purdue earlier in this season, you know, on that, you know, just incredible shot at the end of regulation to win it. They've picked up a couple of good wins along the way, beating Michigan State, beating Ohio State, beating Wisconsin, beating Illinois. I mean, those were massive, massive wins when they absolutely had to have them. But as we know, they are just as capable of losing the clunkers as they, you know, have been able to knock off the big bad guys on the block. I mean, you look at that loss to Illinois earlier this season by 34 points at Illinois. I mean, there are a couple of games here or there where it's just like, really? That's the kind of performance you're going to put up? I think Rutgers is going to win on Tuesday night. I think they're going to beat Notre Dame, but it's going to be, I think, a knockdown, drag 'em out fight here between the Scarlet Knights and the Fighting Irish. Like you said, that Alabama team waiting in the wings there. Another opportunity. Whoever wins this one, I would definitely not count them out at all in their first round matchup against the Crimson Tide, even though Alabama, you know, has shown that they can hang with Gonzaga of all teams, you know, beating them on a neutral site earlier this season. So do I think it's the end of the road for whoever wins on Tuesday between Rutgers and Notre Dame? Not at all. I think whoever picks up the victory in that one could very well make some noise in the first round.
Yep, I do think that Alabama and that matchup, regardless of if it's Notre Dame or Rutgers, going to be very intriguing because, as I mentioned, you do have an Alabama team that they lost to Georgia, and they also beat the two teams that wound up going to the national title game last year as well. So that makes just a whole bunch of sense, as we've got Curtis Rogers of 710 ESPN joining me on the podcast. And Curtis, when you wind up taking a look at the first round of games, so once we wind up getting outside the first four games for Thursday and Friday, is there a game or two that just really stands out to you and you find to be very intriguing? Because I feel like there's no shortage of storylines this year in the NCAA tournament, and I take a look and you've got a lot of rambunctious first-round matchups.
Absolutely. One that I have my eye on is that Providence-South Dakota State game, a 4-13 matchup, where South Dakota State, 13 seed, 30-4, I believe they are only 2-point underdogs right now to Providence.
Correct.
Or, yeah, which, boy, I mean, as a 13 seed against a 4, that to me just kind of screams a misseeding by the committee. So, you know, I've got my eye on that one. If you're wanting to, you know, make a big move in your tournament pool, I think South Dakota State beating Providence could be ripe for the taking. Another game that I am looking at as a potential, you know, maybe an upset here or there, I am going to go Yale and Purdue. Now, Purdue this season has, they've got tons of talent, but they have fallen on their face so many times in big moments. I think back last year where they played North Texas in the first round of the NCAA tournament and once again fell flat on their face. It's just something about this Boilermakers team right now that I am not buying into this time of year. There is a very real possibility that Purdue doesn't make it to the second weekend of the NCAA tournament because they just have not been able to string together quality wins one after the other after the other. They're a team that I have a really hard time buying into. And for as much talent as they have this season, they just have not been able to get out of their own way when the moment is its brightest. And that, to me, is why I think they are ripe for an upset at some point here along the way.
Yep, I do think that Purdue is going to be going out early. I cannot co-sign on that being against Yale. Yale's a team that I felt like they should have probably been on more like the 15-16 seed line. They've got Azir Swain, and they really don't have anyone else. But taking a look at the round of 32, I absolutely do think that Purdue has a good chance of going down to, say, Texas or Virginia Tech. I personally have them going down to Texas. And when it comes to who wound up getting the toughest draw, I know that you're out there in the great state of Washington. I would argue that of all the one seeds, Gonzaga got by far the worst draw. I just take a look at this, and I think that it's going to be very difficult for Gonzaga to make it back to the Final Four. You've got potentially Memphis in the round of 32, and then in the Sweet 16, either UConn or Arkansas. Going to be a tough task. And then if they wind up making it through that, oh boy, you get a rematch of either Texas Tech or Duke, a Duke team that beat them, a Texas Tech team in which made it a first of 65 game, wound up winning. And I think that the committee did absolutely no favors to the number one overall seed in this one.
Definitely not. Definitely not. And also, you mentioned that Memphis game. Boise State is no easy out either, them winning the Mountain West Conference Championship. And also, Leon Rice, with tons of history with Mark Few, who was once on Few's staff at Gonzaga. So there are plenty of storylines abound. You know, I think Gonzaga definitely did get the hardest road to the Final Four in terms of the one seeds. Boy, that is no easy bracket to make your way to New Orleans for the Final Four. I wonder if the selection committee looks at Gonzaga and is like, all right, prove it to us. Prove it to us that we should take you seriously as a national championship contender, which I think is a little unfair, as Gonzaga's made it to the championship game in, what, two of the last five NCAA tournaments that have been held. So it's not like Gonzaga is this new, fresh face on the block anymore. I mean, they're consistently a number one seed in the NCAA tournament, but I do kind of wonder if the tournament selection committee is kind of taking it out on the Zags right now. I look at the other one seeds around the bracket. I think Baylor, they've got an interesting draw as well, especially with UCLA sitting there as the number four seed. UCLA were many people's pick early on this season as a Final Four team. They were a Final Four team last year. They're finally getting healthy right now. You know, when they are at their full strength, I think they are capable of getting to a Final Four. So that, to me, is going to be a potential matchup in the Sweet 16 that I'm going to have my eye on if Baylor and UCLA make it that far.
Yep, I'm right there with you. And I do think that UCLA has a good shot of being able to knock off a Baylor team that is without their top rebounder in Jonathan Chamwa-Chachua. I would say that the easiest road to the Final Four certainly belongs to Kansas. Wisconsin, whenever they've been with Johnny Davis out of the fold slash with Johnny Davis out 100%, that has been a really, really bad team. And I just don't know what Wisconsin really does well. And then you've got an Auburn team that, away from the state of Alabama, they have been terrible. We mentioned it with South Dakota State perhaps being able to knock off Providence. Iowa might honestly be the biggest competition to them, if not San Diego State as well. San Diego State, as a team coming out of that 8-9 matchup, I feel like could give Kansas some fits, but at the same time, I think that Kansas wound up getting the easiest draw here, and I wound up advancing them to my Final Four.
Yeah, I've got them in my Final Four as well. I think they are going to, like you said, have a pretty easy road to it. I mean, I don't see a team in that region where, you know, I see that Kansas is going to have much trouble, if anything, really. I still think Auburn can make some noise. They're definitely helped out by the fact that they're first two games, if they do make it that far, aren't too far away from the state of Alabama playing in Greenville, South Carolina. But look, if they win that first round matchup against Jacksonville State, which I have them to do, USC and Miami, I mean, that is not an easy second round matchup. USC, their record is not indicative of the team that they are. 26-7. I don't think they're as good as their record indicates, but they do have a lot of talent. And I think Andy Enfield can get their team to show up. And, I mean, this is a team that gained a lot of tournament experience last year, making it all the way to, I believe it was the Elite Eight a year ago. And granted, they had Evan Mobley on their team, who is, you know, definitely in the running for NBA Rookie of the Year. But I think Auburn is a team that I look at. They have such boom or bust potential right now. Got to get past that second game. And if they can do that, then maybe they move on. But also in that Midwest region, how about LSU after firing Will Wade? They still get a sixth seed. I don't think that's going to bode very well for them firing their head coach just a couple days before the tournament starts. But yeah, that Midwest region, I feel like if you're picking against Kansas, you're not doing yourself any favors.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And I actually do think that LSU has a chance to be able to make it to the Sweet 16. We have seen once upon a time an interim coach win the national championship in Mr. Steve Fisher while he was over there at Michigan. Now, that was a very, very long time ago. So I do think that they're certainly going to be up against it. But with that said, it has been done before, and something that has been done before and has been done once again. Curtis providing absolutely amazing insights on this podcast. My friend, you do absolutely incredible work over there with Sub 10 ESPN in Seattle. Seattle Sports Night, Seattle Sports Saturday podcast are must-listens as well. Let the good people at home know it's all on tap for you the next few weeks and how people can follow along on social media and other platforms.
Yeah, Greg, we have got a lot in store as the tournament marches on. We're going to obviously keep everybody up to speed, especially with the Zags being the number one seed overall. Huge deal to a lot of people up here in the Northwest. And then also with baseball season finally getting underway, Greg, we can talk about baseball on your baseball podcast at some point here in the next few weeks before the season ramps up. We're getting going with that here in Seattle too. So the Mariners made a big trade today with the Cincinnati Reds. So a lot of reaction to that.
I do think that is going to be so fascinating to see what we wind up getting this baseball season. We've got the moves coming in left and right. And hey, we're actually going to have a break from the college basketball season to the baseball season. So I don't have to overlap podcasts this year. So I'm feeling really good about that. I always keep my college basketball podcast going throughout, but I don't have to do game breakdowns for both of them. So that is going to be very beneficial, just like getting Curtis Rogers on this podcast is as well. Curtis always brings it, did so once again today. So big thanks to him for joining me right here on Coast to Coast Hoops, now part of the VSiN family of podcasts. And coming up next, it is that time of the podcast to give you picks and analysis on every game on the betting board for this College Basketball Wednesday as we hit some bank shots. Las Vegas for Coast to Coast Hoops with myself, Greg Hoopspears, and now part of the VSiN family of podcasts. And it is always a pleasure to get Curtis Rogers on this podcast. He does terrific work over there with 710 ESPN in Seattle. He is going to be experiencing a lot of college basketball these next few weeks, being very close to Gonzaga, so it's going to be very fascinating to see what sort of a run they are going to be able to make. And hopefully on this podcast, we can make a great run with our bets, as we're always getting a great run of information whenever Curtis joins us. So big thanks to him for joining me in the last segment. Now it is that time of the podcast to give you picks and analysis on every game on the betting board for this College Basketball Wednesday as we hit some bank shots.
Most financial establishments close at a certain time, but not here. It is time for a side and total on every game on today's betting board bank shots.
Do note that, as per usual, any changes that are made to these plays will be listed up on my Twitter feed at JarenSquirty1. We're pretty much just going to be going down the line with regards to these tournaments. It's going to be starting with the first four games in the NCAA tournament, then we go to the NIT games, and then we're going to be going to the College Basketball Classic game. So nice, clean, and easy there as we do begin with the first four MIDK Nation picks. 695, 696 on the betting board. Rutgers and Notre Dame are going to be doing battle. Notre Dame is finding themselves a 1-point favorite with your total and between 131.5 and 132. And DK Nation pick is going to be on Rutgers. I'm going to be taking them on the money line. I do think that Rutgers should be able to win this game outright. I did wind up saying them as a 3-point favorite. Big thing with Notre Dame is that they're outside the top 150 with regards to points allowed on a per possession basis. So that is a little bit of an issue. Now, Notre Dame, very solid 3-point shooting team, a team that as a collective, they shoot right around 38% from 3-point range. But with that said, it is a Notre Dame team that they're going to be a little bit weak down low. You've got Cliff Amarui, who does a good job down low for this Rutgers team, is able to give you 8 rebounds per game, and I think it's going to be fascinating to see what we wind up getting in terms of the great ball control that Notre Dame has, one of the best teams at not turning it over in all of college basketball, versus a Rutgers team that has Caleb McConnell, who's able to give you 2.3 steals per contest, and I give a little bit of an edge to McConnell, and then Paul Mouke has been able to do a great job at the point guard spot, 9 points, 5.3 assists. You've got Gio Baker chipping in there nearly 4 assists per contest. It's a Rutgers team that they themselves only turn the ball over right around 11.5 times per contest. Now, they do leave a little bit of something to be desired at the free throw line. They shoot right around 70%. Notre Dame, meanwhile, they just don't give themselves second chances. They do shoot, though, 76% at the free throw line. They shoot about 38% from three-point range. You take a look at the current form that Notre Dame is in, and it's been a bunch that has had a relatively rocky time on defense, giving up at least 69 points in 3 out of their last 5 games. And as a matter of fact, if you want to go back a little bit further, they've given up at least 69 points in 5 out of their last 8. This for a team that is in the bottom 30 of all of college basketball in terms of possessions per game. And I do think that Ron Harper Jr. is going to be the best player out there on the floor. I realize that Blake Wesley has been really catching the eye of a lot of NBA scouts, but he doesn't necessarily shoot the 3 well. Meanwhile, Harper Jr. shoots 39% from 3. He's able to give you 15.5 points, 6 rebounds per game. Rutgers, I just feel like, has also went up against a little bit of better competition, so I think that that is going to be very key for this Rutgers team, a team that has been able to do a relatively solid job on defense, giving up 71 points or fewer in 4 out of their last 5 contests, with that lone outlier being against a very good Iowa team. So DK Nation pick, we're going to be riding with Rutgers on the money line, slash if they wind up becoming a pick'em, we'll be willing to take them as a pick'em. I set my line at 3, and when it comes to this total, I did wind up setting it at a 131. You've got a pair of teams in the bottom bottom 80 with regards to possessions per game. I do think that you wind up getting late game falling, but I think that it's going to be slow and controlled. So looking at the under and the BK Nation pick is Rutgers. 697, 698 on the betting board is the other first four game. You've got Bryant and Wright State. Wright State hopes to be the right side as a 3.5-point favorite. Tulane's game is anywhere between 154.5 and 155. Now, I personally wound up jumping in on this over when it was set significantly lower. This is one that it opened up in a lot of spots right in the neighborhood about 151, 151.5. So I thought that there was very good value there. Now that it's up to between 154.5 and 155, it has crossed my number. I wound up setting this at a 153.5. So I will make that full disclaimer that I wound up taking an early over, but that said, here in this spot, I think that we've gotten up too high to be able to take a look at the over. I'm looking at the under because I did wind up setting my number at 153.5. And with Wright State, I still think that there's value here with them. I wound up setting them as a 5.5-point favorite. They've been steamed up as well, and rightfully so. The Nutter Center, which is where Wright State winds up playing, is out there in the great state of Ohio, and it's about 20 miles away from Dayton. So this is pretty much a pseudo-home game for Wright State. Wright State comes in sizzling. They've been able to do a solid job of being able to put a bunch of wins together, and it's a Wright State team that, even though they're outside the top 100, with regards to total possessions per game, they've been able to do a very good job of being effective on offense. Down the top 75 with regards to points scored on a per possession basis, Tanner Holden is holding it down. 20 points, 7 boards, 2.5 assists. Shoots right around 78% the free throw line. To the credit of Wright State, each of your top four scorers shoot at least 76.9% at the free throw line. Meanwhile, for Bryant, they're a team that they play fast, and they've got the leading score in all of college basketball in Peter Kiss with 25 points per contest. Chips in their 3.5 assists, but that said, Bryant is a bottom 75 team in terms of three-point shooting percentage. They're outside the top 130 with regards to points scored on a per-possession basis. Now, they are in the top 10 with regards to total possessions, and you do have a guy in Hal Alsaeus who's able to give you 3 blocks per contest. I do like Charles Pride as well. He's very versatile with 18 points, 6.5 rebounds, but really none of these guys shoot it well from three-point range. You don't have a single guy on this Bryant team that shoots above 33.5% from three-point range, so that is a little bit of an issue. Greg Kaczlewski is able to give you right around 5.5 rebounds per game, but Grant Bazile is able to give you 18.5 points, 8.5 rebounds, chips in there 2 assists per contest. AJ Braun wound up having a little bit of a rough go of it to begin the season, but he's been able to come on a little bit more. He should be a little bit more of a 5th, 6th man for a team that they really don't go to their bench too much in Wright State, but when they have gone to it, they've been able to get production when needed, and I do think that Tim Finke, his 5 boards, 2.5 assists, going to be a good stabilizer for this team. Wright State, they're only shooting about 33% for the season, but if you take a look at it, ever since the beginning of the month of February, they've been shooting more in the high 30s from 3-point range, so I do think that Wright State going to be able to do a little bit of a better job on defense. Both of these teams are relatively weak on the end of defense, but at the same time, you've got a Bryant team that they don't necessarily do a great job with their jump shots to start with. High stakes game here in the NCAA tournament. I think that they're going to crater a little bit, so I'm going to lay up to 5.5 here with Wright State. Set my total at a 153.5, so I'm going to be taking a look at the under as well. Now we wind up hitting the NIT. This is going to be starting with 699, 700 on the betting board as you've got Toledo, and they are going to be taking on Dayton. Dayton is finding themselves as now a 1-point underdog. They were a 1-point favorite earlier in the day. We have seen a flip of favorites, and your total on this game, you're going to be finding it anywhere between a 143.5 and a 144.5. And in this spot, I did wind up saying Toledo as a 5-point favorite. The big thing is, we wound up seeing it in that Atlantic 10 tournament. You wound up having Malachi Smith go down with an injury, and then from there, you wound up having the Dayton team go down the tubes. Even if Smith winds up playing, I cannot think he's going to be 100%. From all indications, it seems like he's not going to play. Once again, if he does, it's really not going to change my handicap, because just taking a look at that injury, he is certainly not going to be full go in this game if he does wind up going in. That's big for a Dayton team that they relied on him to be able to really trigger the offense. A guy that's able to give you 5.5 assists, 4 rebounds, 9.5 points per contest, and shoots 40% from 3-point range. Now it means that Dayton, they're probably going to need to be looking at other options to be able to run the offense. Someone like a Kobe Elvis to be able to give you 8.5 points. Does shoot right around 37% from 3-point range, so Elvis has been able to enter the building, but you take a look at him whenever he's away from home. He is a guy that he winds up shooting about 41.5% from 3, so he's been a little bit better there, but recent form, 6 points or fewer in 4 of the team's last 5 contests. You've been able to have a little bit out of Elijah Weaver whenever he's been out there in the fold, but he's been a guy that's been banged up. He's unlikely to go in this game as well. Now you do have Tamani Kabara along Deron Holmes. These two guys combined for 23.5 points, right around 13 rebounds, and you got a guy in Holmes that's able to give you 2.5 blocks per contest, but you take a look at this Toledo team, good rebounding up and down the boulevard. Each out of your top five scorers, and four of those guys give you at least 12.5 points per contest. They all give you at least 5.7 rebounds per game. Ryan Rollins, 19 points, 6 boards, does a great job of getting to the free throw line. Toledo as a whole, they shoot 75.5% at the free throw line. Ray J. Dennis has done a good job giving you 4 assists, 12.5 points per contest. JT Shulmate shoots over 50% from 3-point range as a 6'7" combo player. It's been absolutely amazing with 15.5 points, 6 boards per contest. Cedric Milner Jr. shoots 37.5% from 3 as a 6'7" combo player. Toledo, not necessarily the world's deepest team, but been able to get a couple minutes when needed out of someone like a Keyshawn Saunders, who's been a little bit more of a defensive stopper for this team. So I think that Toledo going to be in good shape. Dayton does a good job down low, and Dayton does a good job of being able to slow games down. They're in the top 35 with yards, points allowed on a per-possession basis, bottom 30 in terms of total possessions. Toledo is a team that they're in the top 100 with regards to total possessions, top 25 with regards to points scored on a per possession basis, but defense for them has been relatively solid as well. They wound up even in that loss against Akron, only giving up 70 points. They've given up really 73 or fewer in 4 out of their last 5 contests despite their up-tempo style. So this is a game which I did wind up setting it at a 143 with my total, so I'm going to be taking a look at the under. Now, Toledo made them a 5-point favorite, so we'll take them as a pick'em slash a slight favorite. 701, 702 on the betting board. Towson and Wake Forest are going to be doing battle. Wake Forest is a 7.5 to an 8-point favorite. Draw's game is anywhere between 149 and 149.5. Is that Wake Forest as an 11-point favorite. I do think that Steve Forbes is going to have his team up to play. I know that Wake Forest wound up having that bad end of the season against Boston College, but Forbes is a guy that has coached in lesser tournaments before with East Tennessee State, seems to always get his team up for these games, and it's a Wake Forest team that comes in good offensive form, 77-plus points in 4 of the team's last 5 contests. Meanwhile, Towson, it's been a little bit more rough for them on offense, scoring fewer than 70 points at each of their last 3 games. How the defense has been able to hold up at the point of attack, giving up fewer than 70 points at each their last 5. Is a Towson team that they do rank in the top 80 in terms of both offensive and defensive efficiency. You've got Cameron Holden, who does it all for this team. 13.5 points, 8 boards, 3 assists, 2 steals per contest. Towson, as a collective, they shoot 36% from 3-point range, and they've done a good job of being able to the road this year. Earlier this year, they wound up having a nice road win against Kent State. They played relatively tough when they wound up playing against Ohio State as well. Knocked off a Navy team that's one of the best in defense in all of college basketball by 17 points, but I think that this is a little bit of a different animal for them. You've got Jake Larriva is able to give you 15 points, 6.5 boards, 3.5 assists. Shoots 40% from 3. Davion Williamson shoots 40% from distance with his 12.5 points per contest. And I think that Alondis Williams is going to do a good job of being able to protect the ball. For him, the big thing has been 3.7 turnovers per contest. That's just because he's a high usage guy. 19 points, 6.5 boards, 5.2 assists. He has been absolutely tremendous for this team. You got a 7-footer in Dallas Walton that I just don't think that Towson is going to be able to do a good job against. He's able to haul in their 5 rebounds per game. You just take a look at this Towson team, and they're going to be outgunned with regards to size. They need Charles Thompson, a little bit of a 6'7" bruiser of a big man down low, to do a solid job here. 10.5 points, block and a half for contest, and to his credit, really came on towards the back half of the season, was able to give the team 13 plus points in 3 out of the last 5 contests. And you do have some good sharpshooters for this team. You've got Jason Gibson coupled with Antonio Rizzuto, who give you a combined 17.2 points per contest. They combine to shoot right around 39% from 3 and over 84% at the free throw line. So I do think that you're going to be able to get a couple points in this game. But at the same time, this is a Towson team that they do rank in the bottom 75 with regards to possessions per game. Wake Forest has been a little bit all over the place with regards to their defense. But I think that with the way that Towson plays, it's going to be a little bit more of a slow and controlled game. And I do think that Wake Forest is going to be able to win from within with this game. So I did wind up setting my total here at 145. I'm diving under, and I'm going to lay up to 11 here with Wake Forest laying the points. 7-3, 7-4 on the betting board. Virginia is going to be playing us in Mississippi State. Mississippi State between a 2 and 2.5 point underdog. Your total on this game is anywhere between 123.5 and 124.5. I ended up making Virginia a 4-point favorite in this spot, so I'm going to be willing to lay it with Jaden Gardner. I think that he's going to be able to do a solid job down low for Virginia, a guy that has been able to give you right in the neighborhood about 6.5 rebounds per game, 15 points, and you take a look at the flip side for Mississippi State, just a team that they wound up getting lost towards the back half of the season. They were looking like, honestly, a top 25 team towards like January into maybe even early February, and then things just wound up breaking down for them. This has been a team that has not been the same team whenever they've been on the road as opposed to at home, and big reason why is because they're just not hitting threes. They're shooting as a collective right in the pocket about 30% from three-point range. That is just not going to cut it. This is a team that, with regards to points scored on a per-possession basis, just takes a massive fall off whenever they're away from Starkville. How about 16.3 points per 100 possessions fewer when they are on the road rather than at home? It's a Mississippi State team that I do think that they're going to be able to do an okay job of being able to hold up at the point of attack, but they want to break in 214th with regards to opponents' two-point shooting percentage as well, so they're going to allow this Virginia team to knife inside. And then you've got Reese Beekman, Kia Clark, averaging a little bit over 18 points. Both guys shooting the mid-30s from three-point range, 9.2 assists per game. Kaden Shedrick has been able to give you a little bit over two blocks per contest, and Iverson Molinar, who was very good for three-point range last season, shooting right around 27-ish percent from three-point range this season. So that has been a big, giant issue. Now, I did wind up setting my total at 124. This is not a Virginia team of the past. They rank outside the top 100 with regards to points allowed on a per-possession basis. A little bit unusual, but they still have their slow pace, still dead last in the country with regards to possessions per game. Mississippi State, they're outside the top 250 with regards to possessions per game as well. So they're really looking to slow things down. And with Mississippi State, it's a defense that has really been faltering here towards the back half of the season, now 94th in the country with regards to points allowed on a per-possession basis. So I do think that Virginia, in the end, with the discipline that they've got at the coaching spot with Tony Bennett having his guys up, I like them in the spot. Did wind up setting my total once again at a 124. So seeing this total anywhere between 123.5 and 124, I'd be willing to take it over just because I do think that you're going to get late game fouling. We noticed it with a lot of the games on Tuesday, them going over in the early part. You just have teams that they're willing to let it run a little bit more here in the NIT. So going to be taking a look at the over in this spot. And I'm also going to be willing to lay the points with Virginia. 7-5, 7-6 on the main board. SMU is going to be playing us in Nichols. Nichols is a 15-15.5 point underdog. Total on this game is anywhere between 153 and 153.5. I set my line at 13. I do think that Nichols is going to be able to hang in there. You take a look at their step-up games this season. I recognize it was without Johnny Davis, but they went on the road and they held in there against Wisconsin, losing that game by 3 points. They had a 14-point loss against Purdue when Purdue was at pretty much your fullest of powers. It's a Nichols team that year in and year out, they do a great job of being able to force some steals. This is a team that they were able to generate right around 8.5 per contest, and they do a good job of being able to control the ball. It's a team that they play at a very up-tempo pace in the top 60 with regards to total possessions per game, only turn the ball over right around 12.5 times per contest. Meanwhile, you take a look at what you're able to get on the flip side for SMU, and it is a team that now they're in the top 75 with regards to points allowed on a per-possession basis. You've got the Weathers brothers, Marcus and Michael, that combine for about 23 points per contest. Both of these guys shoot in the pocket of about 38% from three-point range, and it's an SMU team that they do a relatively solid job with regards to being able to hunker down on defense. It is a team that does allow second chances, though. They're a team that they give up right around 28% of opponents' misses as a second chance, and that's going to be big because you do have Manny Littles, who's able to give you 9 points, 8 rebounds per game for a Nichols team that they only shoot about 33% from three. And the big trepidation you have with Nichols, they shoot 63% at the free throw line. That said, this is a team that they do a good job. Ty Gordon give you 21.5 points, 3 assists, ceiling per contest, shooting 36% from 3-point range. Javonte Carter comes in from Norfolk State, 12 points, 4 boards, 4 assists. Now, when it comes to SMU, Kendrick Davis going to be the best guard out there, 19.5 points, 4 boards, 4.5 assists, shoots 37.5% from 3-point range, but it's a guy that's going to get loose with it a little bit more. He wound up having to combine 8 turnovers in the final 3 contests. It's an SMU team that you take a look at them for the season, right around 12.5 turnovers per game, so not bad, not great. 74% free throw shooting team. Emmanuel Bandamel has been able to shoot 37% from 3-point range with 10.5 points per contest, but did wind up having 10 points or fewer in 3 of the team's final 5 contests. I do think that SMU going to be able to get by. I do think that they're going to be able to get the job done, and I do think that it's going to be a relatively up-tempo game. I do think that you're going to get plenty of possessions here, but I think that you've went a little bit too lofty with this total because this wound up opening up anywhere between 148 and 149. I was all aboard the over there. You're at 153. It's the max I'd be willing to take at the over. Once you wind up hitting 153.5, then I'll be on the under at 153 or less. I am still aboard on the over, but just know that this is a total that it wound up rising, and it wound up rising very quickly when I wound up taking it. So I like the over, but once again, 153 is going to be my max, and with SMU, made them a 13-point favorite, so we'll take 15-plus here with Nichols. 7-7, 7-8 on the bang board. St. Louis and Northern Iowa is going to be doing battle. Northern Iowa, 4.5 to a 3.5-point underdog in your total loss game. Going to be fighting anywhere between 148.5 and 149, and this is the spot in which I did wind up saying St. Louis as a 6-point favorite. I like the fact that this is dropping because I'm going to be willing to lay. With Northern Iowa, you've got A.J. Green, who's been able to do a magnificent job for this team. He's able to give you 19 points, shooting from 3-pointers to 37.5%, and he's shoots 91.5% at the free throw line. You take a look at the way that this Northern Iowa team has been able to function on offense, and it has been terrific. With regards to points scored on a per-possession basis, they're in the top 70 in all of college basketball, but this is a St. Louis team that they themselves have been able to do a solid job of being able to shape things up on offense. This is a team that they clock in more around 70th with regards to points scored on a per-possession basis, and they're going to be able to win the battle down low. Northern Iowa, you don't have a single guy that gives you more than 6 rebounds per game. As a matter of fact, their leading rebounder, that would be Trey Barrow. He gives you 5.1 rebounds per contest, so that is going to be a little bit of an issue against the St. Louis team that does have Francis Okoro down low, a guy that's able to give you 8 rebounds, like what he's able to bring to the table. Now, Yuri Collins gets loose with it. 4 turnovers per contest, but with that said, they're going up against the Northern Iowa team that you take a look at them, and they just have not been able to do a good job of being able to pickpocket all season long. They only give you right around 5.5 steals per contest. Barrow along with Nate Hesse, who gives you 9 points, 4.5 boards. They both generate a steal per game. And to the credit of Northern Iowa, among your top 4 scorers, 3 of them shoot at least 37.3% from 3-point range in Northern Iowa, 79% at the free throw line. But this is not the St. Louis team of old. This is a St. Louis bunch that now they're shooting right around 76.5% at the free throw line. They shoot 37% from 3 with Gibson Jimerson headlining this, 16 points per contest. Fred Thatch is able to give you 9.5 points, 5.5 boards. This is a St. Louis team that they've been able to build a little bit of depth with Martin Lisson, along with Terrence Hargrave Jr., both giving you right around 7 points, 4 rebounds per contest. So I do like the overall makeup of this St. Louis team. Wish they would have had Jarrante Perkins not go out of the fold early on during the season, but I do think the Northern Iowa can have a little bit of a tough time in this spot. They've been giving up their fair share of points, 75-plus, in 3 out of the last 5 contests. Meanwhile, you've got a St. Louis team that they come in playing some of their best defense, 65 points or fewer in 3 out of their last 4 games, so I do like St. Louis to be able to get the job done in this spot against a Northern Iowa team that is just flat-out terrible at being able to give themselves second chances, one of the worst in all of college basketball in that regard. So I did wind up setting my line at 6. I'm willing to lay it with St. Louis. Did wind up setting my total at a 146 as well. So this is the spot in which I'm going to be taking a look at the under, and I'm going to be willing to take St. Louis. 709, 710 on the betting board. Florida is going to be taking on Iona. Iona is a 6.5-point underdog in your tallest game, anywhere between 143.5 and 145.5. This is a full disclaimer. I'm doing this thinking that there's going to be nobody that winds up opting out for Florida because Florida has underwent a coaching change. If you do wind up seeing players that decide that they're not going to play in this game, this is going to be a little bit of subject to change, but assuming that we've got Florida at full go, I did wind up setting them as an 8-point favorite. Colin Castleton, I think, is just going to be able to dominate this game. 16 points, 9 boards, 2.5 blocks per contest. You've got some very good guards for this team as well. Tyree Appleby, 11 points, 3.5 assists. She's right around 34% from 3-point range. You've had Marion Jones shoot 33% from distance, 8.5 points per contest. I like what you've been able to get out of Brandon McKissick as well. A little bit of a glue guy, doesn't necessarily score a lot with 6 points per contest, but a good on-ball defender. It will give you a seal per contest, and that's really a redeeming quality for Florida. This is a team that they do generate right around 8 steals per game, and you just take a look at this Florida defense. It is incredibly different home to road. Florida overall for this season, they're a team that with regards points a lot on a per-possession basis. I mean, they were solid if you take a look at it at number 85, but with regards to points allowed on a per possession basis at home, they give up 14.2 fewer per 100 possessions rather than when they are on the road. And this is an Iona team that overall on defense, they've been relatively solid. You take a look at them, they're right around 56 with this metric, but they're giving up a little bit more than 10 points more per 100 possessions when they are in a road and neutral court environment. You've got Tyson Jolly, who's able to give you 15.5 points per contest, shoots 37% from 3. I do like what you're able to get out of Elijah Joyner as well. Not necessarily a guy that's going to score a ton, but is a guy that does a good job of not turning the ball over, gives you 3.5 assists, 1.7 steals per game, along with 11.5 points per game. Quinn Slezniski has been able to shoot it well from 3-point range, along with Dylan Van Eyck, both of these guys north of 6'8". Both of these guys combine to shoot 35% from 3, and Nelly Jr. Joseph, he does give you 2 blocks per contest, but with Iona, I do have my question marks with this team. They only shoot about 33% from distance, 69.5% at the free throw line. They don't necessarily generate a lot of steals, so a Florida team that's a little bit shaky out there in the backcourt, I think that they should be able to get the job done in this spot. I do think that Colin Castleton going to be able to hold things down. And if you're asking about motivation, I do think that the Florida guys are going to respond well to the interim coaching regime. All the guys are still there for them. So I do like Florida to be able to get the job done, set them as an 8-point favorite. I do think that the travel going from New York to Florida, it's going to take a little bit out of Iona as well. Didn't want to sing this total at a 144. So I'm going to be taking a look at the 145 to 145 and a half under, because I do think the Florida going to be able to do a good job of being able to box down Iona, and Florida, as I mentioned, much better team on defense at home. So looking at the under and looking at Florida, last game for the NIT before we hit the basketball classic, 7-11, 7-12. You've got BYU playing us to Long Beach State. Long Beach State, an 11.5 point underdog. John's game is anywhere between 151.5 and 152.5. And I set my line at 13 with BYU. I do think that they're going to be able to take over against the Long Beach State team that they looked solid out there in Big West play. Take a look prior to Big West play. Long Beach State was very shaky, though. I'm wondering how much of this was a product of the conference just not being so great with Long Beach State. You do have Joel Murray coupled with Colin Slater. These two guys combined to be able to give you 31 points. They both give you 3 assists per apiece, and both guys shoot at least 84.5% the free line and 38% from three-point range. They've been rock solid, but BYU's going to have the best score out there on the floor. That would be Alex Barcelo. 17 points, 3 assists, shooting 44% from 3, 87% at the free throw line. And then you've got down low a guy in Fusani Traoré, who's been able to give you 8.5 rebounds per game. I like the skill set of Gideon George. 8 points, 5 rebounds, very athletic big man that's able to step out and shoot right around 33% from three-point range. Not necessarily too much of a shot blocker, unfortunately, but you've got a little bit more of that with some of the other ancillary pieces of this team. Caleb Lawner has been able to give you 6.5 points, 6.5 boards. He does a good job in the post as well. With BYU, turnovers have been a little bit of an issue, but you've got a Long Beach State team that they're generating 7 steals per contest, but a lot of that is because they rank in the top 50 with regards to possessions per game. BYU has sped themselves up a little bit as well. They're in the top 125 now with regards to possessions per game. You've been able to have some good low post play out of Abdu Traoré as well. Joe Hampton was relatively solid when Long Beach State wound up having him out there on the floor, but I would say that a few of their losses late came because he was off the floor. A guy that was able to give you 9 points, 3.5 boards, was able to stretch the floor, being able to shoot some threes. Now you do have Jaden Jones being able to shoot about 37.5% from three. He's able to chip in their 10.5 points per contest, but I do think that BYU going to be able to do a relatively solid job on defense. With BYU has been a little bit hit or miss with this team, but you take a look at them in regards to what points allowed on a per possession basis. They're still in the top 100. They're giving up 9.5 points per 100 possessions, fewer when they are at home rather than on the road. And though Long Beach State does play at a relatively up-tempo pace, 194th in the country with regards to points scored on a per-possession basis. They score right around 8.5 points per 100 possessions, fewer when they are on the road as well, having to go to Provo, having to go to a little bit of elevation. I do think that's going to be a little bit tough on this team. I could see some tired legs late in this one. Set my total at 146 because I think that the elevation gets at both teams. So I'm looking at the under. And with BYU, set them as a 13-point favorite, so I'm going to be willing to lay the points. Now we hit the basketball classic games, and we're going to be starting with this first game of 853-854 on the betting board. Detroit is going to be taking on Florida Gulf Coast. Dunk City, the home team, is anywhere between 2 and 2.5-point favorites. And your total on this game is anywhere between 149.5 and 150.5. And it's a spot in which I did wind up setting this total at 146.5. Now, you've got a Detroit team that is brutal on defense outside the top 250 with regards to points allowed on a per-possession basis. But I just don't know if you're going to get enough possessions to be able to warrant an over in this game, just because it's a Detroit team that they rank in the bottom 50 with regards to total possessions per game. Florida Gulf Coast, they are going to be without a coach as well, as they wound up letting go of their coach a couple of days before this one. So Michael Fly is going to be out of the fold, but you got a lot of guys with pride for Florida Gulf Coast. Now, I want to see if there's any opt-outs, because if you do wind up seeing someone like a Tavion Dunn-Martin, who gives you 21 points per contest and shooting 36% from three, be out of the fold, that is something that you need to take into account. Kevin Samuel, 12 points, 9.5 rebounds, 3 blocks per game. He has been terrific. Cyrus Largique, Luketo, they combined to be able to give you nearly 19 points per contest. Dunk City is a collective. They shoot 35% per three. Now, they do turn the ball over 13.5 times per game, but the good news is this is a Detroit team that they don't force a lot of steals. Right around 6 per contest. You gotta love to be able to get out of Antoine Davis. 24 points per contest. Shoots 38% from 3-point range. Mudu Asech wound up coming back for the Ryzen League tournament, but did not look like himself. Wound up missing a bunch of February due to an injury. Guy that's able to give you 12.5 points, 7 boards, 6'7" combo player. So him not being at 100%, something that needs to be taken into account. And then it looked like DJ Harvey was going to be going into takeover mode for this Detroit team. 10 points or fewer now 4 out of the last 5 games. So after you wind up having a hot late January, early February, you wind up having a fall off as well. It's a Detroit team that they shoot 78% the free throw line, 37.5% from 3-point range. They do a relatively solid job there, but Detroit is a team that they do not do a good job on the glass. It's a team that, with regards to defensive rebound rate, 281st in all of college basketball. On road and neutral court environments, they allow second chance on 30.7% of opponents' missed shots. I think that is going to really come back to bite them in this game. Florida Gulf Coast at home, they only allow a second chance on right around 23% of opponents' misses. So it's a good spot here for Florida Gulf Coast, in my opinion. I did wind up setting them as a 2.5-point favorite. I'm willing to lay up to 2.5 here once again. If we do wind up seeing opt-outs with Florida Gulf Coast, that is a little bit of a fear here, because they do wind up having a interim coaching regime who's going to be in for this one. That would change my numbers a little bit. But assuming Florida Gulf Coast is full go. Won't lay up to 2.5 with them. Also did wind up setting my total at a 146.5 with the way that Detroit winds playing. So looking at the under as well. 855, 856 on the betting board. Coastal Carolina going to be playing against Maryland Eastern Shore. The Shore is between a 13.5 to a 14-point underdog. In your totals anywhere between 131 and 131.5. Maryland Eastern Shore in non-conference play was one of the slowest teams in all of college basketball. They got sped up to being more of a mid-tempo team, but that's just a product of the MEAC because literally everyone aside from them in the MEAC plays at just an absolute breakneck pace. So I do think that playing against a Coastal Carolina team that is outside the top 200 with regards to possessions per game, things are going to be a little bit more bottled up. That said, I do think that Coastal Carolina going to be able to get them here. I did wind up setting this total at a 133, and I'm willing to lay up to 15 with Coastal Carolina because I think that Isam Mustafa is going to be able to have himself a day down low. 13.5 points, 9.5 boards. You don't have to talk to Coastal Carolina about motivation. They were in the CBI last year, and they were able to make a run in the CBI, so they are very battle-tested there. Rudy Williams, Vince Cole, these two guys are able to combine for a little bit over 29 points per contest. Both shoot over 40% from three-point range, and Nabri Madiba, 8 points, 5.5 assists, right around 1.4 steals per contest. And Williams, Cole, and Deba, I'll give you between 1.3 and 1.4 steals per contest. Now, Maryland Eastern Shore, their heart and soul of this team is being able to generate steals. 10.2 per contest. They're in the top 20 in all of college basketball in that regard. They shoot only 65% at the free throw line. They've been dealing with some injuries to Dom London along Zion Stiles. Both of these guys should be good to go in this one. You wound up having Stiles return for the MEAC tournament. Had 8 points and 6 rebounds in that game, but wound up also having 5 turnovers in that contest. Dom London is a guy that has been back for a little bit now, has looked relatively the same. So I don't think that you're going to have any fall off with the injury concern guys. You've also been able to have a few guys be able to step up without them, as well as Kevon Foyles is now able to give you right around 9 points per contest, 7 plus points at each of the last 5 contests. But that's it. Other than Nathaniel Pollard, who's able to give you 6.5 rebounds per game, nobody else gives you more than 3.5 boards per game. I think that that's going to be a big issue for the Shore in this spot. So it is a situation which I do want to say in Coastal Carolina here as a 15-point favorite. I think that things are going to be a little bit more slowed down, but I think the Maryland Eastern Shore just not going to be able to match up with the Coastal Carolina team that does a good job from three and has a good post presence. Set my total at 133 as a result. So going over and one delayed here with Coastal. 857, 858 on the betting board. You've got UMBC, and they're going to be taking on Merrimack. The Merrymen of Merrimack are between 6.5 and 7-point underdogs. Drawing this game is anywhere between 136 and 137. The metrics themselves tell me that UMBC should be right around a 7 to 7.5-point favorite. I shaved this down to 5.5 because with UMBC, I just don't know how they're going to deal with this strange zone that Merrimack winds up playing. It's very unfamiliar to them. The reason why you wound up seeing Merrimack be really good out of conference and then not so good in conference is because the conference post, they're now used to it a little bit more. UMBC is not going to be used to it. So I think that that's a big determiner in this game. And Jordan Miner, he is very major for Merrimack. It will give you 15 points, 8 boards. It will give you 2.5 blocks, a steal and a half per contest. This guy has been absolutely magnificent. 8 plus rebounds in 4 out of the team's last 5 contests. Meanwhile, for UMBC, it's a team that they knock down their shots. They're shooting 78.5% of the free throw line. That's in the top 15 in all of college basketball. And they shoot nearly 38% from 3-point range. So they're able to do a quality job there. Keontae Kennedy is able to give you 15 points per contest, a guy that does a very good job of being able to chip in there, a steal and 5 rebounds per contest as well. But the thing is, with this UMBC team, the only other guy that gives you more than 5.1 rebounds per game, that'd be Abeng Masena. He's been able to give you 7 points, 5.5 rebounds, 6'7" combo player, but he's been falling out of favor with this team a little bit as well. 13 minutes or fewer in 4 out of the team's last 5 contests. That is a big concern for this team. Now with Merrimack, this is a team that they do not do a good job on the glass. Out of 358 D1 teams, they allow the most offensive rebounds in all of college basketball. Nearly an offensive rebound on 34.7% of opponents misses. But it's not like this Maryland-Baltimore County team is necessarily doing a tremendous job either. They rank right around 190th with this metric as well. So even though Merrimack is going to get bludgeoned a little bit on the glass, I do think that they're going to be able to force turnovers on a UMBC team. They've only turned the ball over right around 11 times per contest, but I just think that that Merrimack style is really going to get to them in this spot. You do have a UMBC team that when it comes to when they wind up hitting the road as well, they seem to be a little bit affected because they shoot 43.8% from three-point range at home, 33.7% on the road. That I think is very important. And then you take a look at the Merrimack backcourt. Mikey Watkins is able to give you 4.5 assists per contest. Merrimack is a team that they themselves only turn the ball over right around 11.5 times per contest. They do shoot 67.5% of the free throw line. It's a little bit of an issue, but Ziggy Reed, 11 points, 5 boards, 1.3 steals per contest. I think that he's going to do a solid job of keeping Merrimack live. I think that the style itself is going to cause UMBC to have some issues in this game. I did wind up setting my total at a 130.5. I do think that Merrimack going to be able to provide themselves a lot of pride on the defensive end. line in this spot, so I'm looking at the under. And with UMBC, I wound up setting them as a 5.5-point favorite, so taking a look at the points. 861, 862 on the betting board. South Alabama is going to be taking on Southeast Louisiana. Southeast Louisiana, anywhere between a 9.5 to a 10-point underdog. Totals anywhere between 149 and 149.5. I set this South Alabama being a 10-point favorite. 10 is the absolute max I'm willing to lay, but I'm going to be willing to lay 10 with Southeast Louisiana. They do wind up having a road win this year against another Sun Belt team in Troy, but I do take a look at the South Alabama team, and I just think that there's a little bit too much talent on this team to not be able to get the job done, because you take a look at South Alabama, I love what you're able to get down low out of Javon Franklin, a guy that winds up coming in from Auburn, 11.5 points, 7.5 rebounds per game. Now Jalen Hinton, he's in the glass for Southeast Louisiana, 14 points, 8 rebounds, a guy that's able to give you 2.5 blocks per contest, a steal per game as well, so he's been able to do a superb job there. And you just take a look at last three games, he wound up giving the team 17 blocks and had 16 plus points in two of those games. So, I mean, he is absolutely tremendous. Keon Clergeau, he's able to do a good job out there in the backcourt, 13 points, 3 assists, but also turns the ball over 3 times for contests as well. This is a South Alabama team that really hangs its hat on defense, and you take a look at what South Alabama is doing home to road, it is very stark with regards to points allowed on a per possession basis, 13.9 points fewer per 100 when they are on their home floor rather than when they are on the road. And you do take a look at this spot as well, and you've got to figure that this is probably going to be a team without J.J. Chandler, wound up missing the team's Sun Belt tournament game. That was a little bit of an issue for this team, a guy that's able to give you 15 points per contest, but you are going to have Charles Manning out there. And Manning is a guy that's able to give you 16 points, 3.5 assists, a block, and a steal per game as a 6'4" do-it-all player. K.O. Gonsalves is a guy that's able to give you 7.5 points, 4 boards, able to shoot 35% from 3-point range. Ryan Burkhardt is someone that wanted coming in from North Florida, and he's been relatively solid for the Southeast Louisiana team. Guy that's able to give you 9 points, shoots 43% from 3-point range, but just a big bugaboo with the Southeast Louisiana team in general is just allowing the 3. It's not like South Alabama is necessarily going to go bombs away from 3-point range, but this is a Southeast Louisiana team that they rank outside the top 300 with regards to points allowed on a per possession basis, so that's an issue. And with regards to Southeast Louisiana on the road, they allow opponents to shoot 36% from 3-point range, and they're even worse on the interior. So I do think that the guys like Javon Franklin and company are going to be able to eat inside. As a result, I did want to say South Alabama as a 10-point favorite. I do think that they're going to be able to take a little bit of pride in their defense, semi-total at 144, so I'm going to be looking at the under as well. By the way, in case you were wondering, 859, 860, New Orleans and Portland, that game has been rescheduled for, it looks like, Saturday. That's why that wound up getting skipped, but we go to 863, 864. Southern Utah going to be playing us at Kent State. The Golden Flashes of Kent State find themselves a 1 to 1.5 point favorite, and your Toronto's game is anywhere between 140.5 and 141. On a neutral floor, I would be making Kent State probably like a 4 to 5 point favorite, but I just think that the late travel, having to take this game at the last minute, is really going to be messing with Kent State. You also have to wonder if there's going to be any underlying suspensions with what we wound up seeing in that MAC tournament game as well. You wound up seeing nearly half the team be suspended for the first half of that contest, and it might have costed them a trip to the NCAA tournament. So I'm waiting for the shoe to fall on that. Now, you are going to have Sincere Carey out there, and he's sincerely going to be the best player in this game, in my opinion. 18 points, 4.5 boards, 4.8 assists. Guy that shoots 35.5% from 3-point range, but you take a look at the Southern Utah team, you got a pair of guys that give you 14.5 points per contest. Savion Jones, John Knight III. They both combine to be able to give you 9 rebounds. Knight is able to give you 4 assists, 2 steals per contest, shoots 37% from 3. It's a Southern Utah team that, with regards to defense, it's not like they're necessarily like a bulldozer or anything like that, but they're improving, especially when they are at home. This is a team that, with regards to points allowed on a per possession basis, right around 98.5 whenever they are at home. This is a Kent State team that, prior to losing in the MAC tournament, they were white hot. They had won 13 straight games. It's a team that they do rank at the top 100 with regards to points allowed on a per possession basis, and they should be able to hold their own on the glass. Mason Fawcett for the Southern Utah team is able to give you right around 8 boards. He chips in there, 12.5 points per contest, and does shoot 33% from 3-point range. Meanwhile, you take a look at Kent State. Justin Hamilton is a guy that stands right around 6'10", 8.5 points, 6.5 boards, has been rock solid. But you do take a look at Kent State as well. Among your top 3 scorers, 2 of them shoot sub 29% for 3-point range. Malik Jacobs is one of those guys that was suspended for the first half of that tournament game. He was able to give the team 12.5 points, 7.5 boards overall for the season. So got some question marks there. Andrew Garcia has been a very good sharpshooter for this Kent State team. 8.5 points per contest. Shoots overall for the season 45% for 3, but just 33% on the road. It's a Kent State team that they just don't necessarily do a great job with regards to outside shooting. Their free throw shooting percentage still at 75%, but it has fallen in the latter weeks of the season. So I do think that Southern Utah, especially being a team that's able to go right around 8 deep, should be able to get it done here. Did wind up setting my total at 144.5. Kent State, little bit more of a slow team. Southern Utah, a team that's willing to kick up the tempo. I do think that winds up coming down to late game fouling. Southern Utah, they now shoot right around 71.5% at the free throw line. So I'm willing to take Southern Utah as a money line underdog, and I'm willing to take a look at the over with setting my total at 144.5 and wrap things up with 865-866. Youngstown State is going to be playing us at Morgan State. Morgan State's between a 6.5 and a 7-point underdog in your total on this game, say between 149 and 149.5. I said Youngstown State as an 11.5-point favorite. I don't understand why this number is so low. You take a look at what you're able to get out of this Youngstown State team, and I think that they're going to be able to do a very solid job, as you've got Dwayne Coyle, who's been able to pair very well up there in the backcourt with Tavion Olison. These two guys combined for 27 points per contest. Both guys give you 4.5 boards. Coyle is able to shoot 40% for three. Olison shoots 36% from 3-point range. It's a Morgan State team that they play at a breakneck pace. They are number one in the country with regards to total possessions per game. They're just not efficient, though. You take a look at them. Points scored on a per possession basis. Morgan State is 331st in the country, and they're scoring 12.5 points fewer per 100 possessions when they are in a road and neutral court environment. That is going to be a big giant issue. This is a Youngstown State team that they do an okay job of being able to bury their threes at right around 34.5% as collective, more like 35.5% when they are at home. And you take a look at this Morgan State bunch, and it just has not necessarily been so rosy for them. You were expecting a whole heck of a lot more out of so many of these guys, like a DeTorian Ware, who in conference averaged right around 20 points per game last season. This year he's averaging overall 10.5 points, 5 rebounds per game. It's a Morgan State team that they shoot 67.3% at the free throw line. They turn the ball over 15.5 times for contests as well. This is not a team that necessarily does the world's greatest job on the glass either. And you've got Michael Okuchi for this Youngstown State team. It will give you 13 points, 7 rebounds per contest. It's not like Youngstown State is going to go down and barrel down the hatches with regards to the boards, but they rank in the top 130 with regards to rebound rate. And then you take a look at Morgan State out of your 358 D1 teams. This is a team that they clock in more on 200, and they get a 57.5% rebound rate at home, 47.4% on the road. You just saw it all non-conference long. I think that Morgan State wanted covering two games out of conference all season long, because they're just a team that they were able to do a solid job against a lacquer MAC competition, but when they wound up going up against better teams in the non-conference portion, they just couldn't get the job done. I think that Youngstown State just has more talent in this spot. Said Youngstown State as an 11.5-point favorite. Didn't want to make it my total 149.5. I do think that things are going to be a little bit frenetic. 149.5 is the max I'd be willing to take the over on, but willing to take the over to go along with Youngstown State. And that will wrap things up for the Wednesday edition of Coast to Coast Hoops, now part of the VSiN Family of Podcasts. A big thanks to Curtis Rogers of 710 ESPN in Seattle for joining me in the last segment. If you like what you're hearing from this fine podcast, Coast to Coast Hoops, you're able to subscribe wherever you hear podcasts: Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you have a question, comment, segment idea, what have you for this podcast, got one or two ways for you to fire those in. First one is my Twitter timeline, at @JRScorty1. Keep in mind, letters CM, they mean does not matter. So as per usual, please send these into the timeline and the other way, find an Apple Podcast review. If you rate this podcast 5 stars, it is very much appreciated. From there, you're able to fire whatever you'd like to hear on this podcast via that 5-star review. I'm going to be coming at you guys every single day throughout the college basketball season. That means I'm coming at you guys once again tomorrow. Thank you so much for tuning in.